Straight out of Finland, this is the Reluctant Theologian Podcast. I am your host, Dr. R.T. Mullins from the University of Helsinki's Collegium for Advanced Studies. Dr. Emma Sani and I have been working on a paper on open theism and molecular biology. In today's episode, we explore some questions about the relationship between different scientific disciplines and theology. When we take a closer look at the biological world, we see a vast array of risk management systems that anticipate genetic errors and seek to correct them. Emma explains these biological phenomena for us, and then we discuss how this can help the open theist develop her own understanding of the God-world relation. Is the God of open theism too risky? Stick around and find out. If you have questions or topics that you'd like to hear on the show, you can send me a message at rtmullins.com. Ready or not, here's Emma and I talking about biology. Enjoy.
Okay, Ryan, I have a question for you that I wanted to ask you for a while, especially because now we interact in a lot about different subject matters. So I think it's time for me to ask you this question. So why is it important to consider a scientific approach to theology, and how do you think science can help with this?
Okay, so a scientific approach to theology, right. So there's a couple different ways that science can help with regards to theology. So the first thing that a lot of people point out is that science can support a premise in an argument for the existence of God, or maybe support a premise in an argument against the existence of God. Mm-hmm. So it's not like I can just look at a science paper and then just go, haha, there's God, and just read it right off the science paper.
That'd be nice.
It'd be nice, but it doesn't work that way.
And final.
It would be, yes, exactly. And then it would get retracted and then, then whatever. Yeah. Anyway, so it's typically it would be something that would support a premise in an argument. So for example, the Kalam cosmological argument that we talked about before. Mm-hmm. So one of the premises is that the universe began to exist. And so, well, what do? You can look at different scientific theories like Big Bang cosmology that support the universe having a beginning. There's other things you could do, though, it seems to me. So you could say science could support a premise in an argument for and against a particular model of God. So it don't have to just be just God mm-hmm. in some sort of generic sense, but actually, maybe some actually specific models of God. So again, this Big Bang cosmology, if that really does strongly suggest an absolute beginning to the universe, well, then it seems to me that that would support models of God that affirm creation ex nihilo. So classical theism, neoclassical, open theism, these sort of views.
Right.
Whereas if that turns out to be false, then that in the universe is always existed, mm-hmm. then that might support a panentheistic model of God that denies creation out of nothing. Because on panentheism, they say God always exists with a universe of some sort. And so that could support a premise in an argument for panentheism. Mm-hmm. One other possible twist could be, if we're looking at the laws of nature, maybe we just figure out that everything in the universe is completely determined. Well, that would fit really nicely with different models of God that say God determines absolutely everything.
Okay.
Or if it turns out that the laws of nature aren't completely determined and maybe the future is open, then that's going to support different models of God. They're going to say, no, we've got a God who's created a universe that's open in some sense, and when he creates an open future. So it would kind of support an open theistic model. So these would be some ways I think you could have science supporting premises in arguments for and against different models of God.
Okay. So I have the feeling that whatever you described so far is all about physics, and mm-hmm. I'm feeling there's an awful lot of philosophy interaction.
Yeah.
What are we going to do about the other scientists? Are we going to throw out of the window? We're not going to use them?
They don't matter, right?
Biology, I'm sure it can give you some explanation of why we're living in a world like this. Or chemistry can also give you some good explanation about certain things. And even other things, I don't know, if you want to include psychologists into the science, mm-hmm. if you want to be that charitable. Now joking, we love that.
Yes.
Maybe, you could have other signs there that could lead you to something, right? Especially when we look at our biological world, we can drive some conclusion about a creator if such a thing exists, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Now, historically, that's been the case. So what you're talking about is a discipline called natural theology. And so in Eastern and Western religious traditions, there's been this long tradition of reflecting on the general features of the world and then trying to develop arguments for and against the existence of God. And so you've got like the cosmological arguments that we talked about earlier, but there's also a long tradition of these design arguments that will look at different biological and chemical features in the world and say, these look like they're designed. Or a better kind of argument is typically to say, which is more likely to get this kind of biological outcome? A universe that has a designer or a universe that has no designer? So what kind of hypothesis would raise the likelihood that we'd find a universe like this? And then same thing with if you're looking at psychology, I mean, there's a lot of different arguments from consciousness to the existence and nature of God, saying like, again, you could run these sort of arguments of we get this outcome of consciousness being like a feature, a major feature of the world. Where does that come from? Can that come from a hypothesis where consciousness is not a fundamental feature of reality, where it just kind of like emerges somehow? And you just say emerge in this nice kind of way that implies something that's not magical, supposedly. Or
pretty magical.
It sounds like it's like magical, but you know, it's a story for another day. Or is there, is consciousness at like a rock bottom feature of reality? And so then we should again expect the universe to have other conscious things within it. And so this kind of goes back to that earlier, the earlier question, which is, seems like these different scientific disciplines, what they can do is they can support a premise and argument for the existence of God, or maybe an argument for a particular model of God. It seems to me that's the way it could go.
No, this is really interesting. And I feel like we should resurrect some of these disciplines because it seems like left aside since the genome, for example, biology, and I don't know how much you guys engaged since the 1990s stuff. Genome Project, that's probably the last thing that's been looked at. Then, you know, 30 years passed and something happened in between there.
See, this is the thing, is like the impression we get is nothing's really happened in biology. Just evolution and that's it. And then nothing else is interesting story to tell.
Amazing. Like CRISPR, I mean, just to say one thing, you know, that we just got, you know, Nobel Prize winner for it.
You know, nothing of theological interest there. Nothing there to see.
The fact that we genetically modified baby last year, nothing interesting.
Nothing interesting to see. This doesn't tell us anything about human nature. I don't know. But no, like I think your point is well taken. Is it does seem that there's a lot of stuff that's happened within the discipline of biology, and theologians have not done a great job at keeping up to date with that. And philosophers as well. A lot of philosophy of biology is just philosophy of evolution and philosophy of mechanisms. What about all this other stuff? Unless you're in like bioethics, then they're kind of getting in the nitty gritty details.
Yeah, bioethics, I think they have their hands full.
They've got their hands full with all sorts of stuff. But yeah, they're the only ones, I think, kind of keeping up with some of these things here. So that's what I want to get into some discussion with you about here.
That's why I'm here today.
So the planet that we're living on, it seems like it's thriving with like an incredible amount of variety of life forms, which are not just simply just living, but they're also like flourishing. And we've got all, and they're flourishing in lots of different ecosystems. So what do you think is the key to their fundamental, like, biological success? Like, how are they doing this?
This is a very good question. You know, biological systems are incredibly sophisticated. You just try to think, for example, all the complex tasks a human body does at any given moment without even being aware that it's doing that. So your heart is beating all the time, but you're not thinking about your heart to make it beat. To every single cell of your body is just performing its function all the time without you being even aware. So how sophisticated is that? No wonder we have lots of problems to understand how we are and how things work. But if you look at a system like that, so sophisticated, you would think that maybe the success, the biological success of this system is because it's extremely specialized. So every biological pathway that is happening is just optimized, efficiently optimized to achieve one clear defined goal and using one efficient and optimal pathway. So just that. But if you think about, if you have a system like that, it's just so tailored to one specific purpose. If something happened, if it's a small little thing, the whole this system will collapse. And be so dangerous for the whole organism.
Right. So if the organism is designed to just do one thing and one thing only. And then like a slight little change in course, like, ooh, well, that just screws the entire thing up.
Well, you have a perfect system, which is not perfect. Because it does not account for errors at all or unforeseen circumstances.
Like, that seems less than ideal to me then, if it can't account for unforeseen circumstances or any changes.
Absolutely. So you imagine that you need some level of flexibility in there. Mm-hmm. How much? It's difficult to say, but you need to be flexible to react, for example, external changes. Mm-hmm. But how do you do this? Well, biological systems are amazing because they are really flexible, but they also have lots of contingency plans or risk management solutions. For example, higher living organisms have evolved so many redundant processes that are able to complete the same task, but in different ways. And they also use different surveillance mechanisms and error repairing mechanisms. So if an error happens, mm-hmm. you'll be able to, you know, overcome the mistake. So even in case of failing, if something goes wrong, the mechanism, you know, will have a good outcome in the end. So one way to maintain this type of flexibility, it's, you know, try to have many way to go to the same goal. Mm-hmm. And so basically, this is the definition of redundancy. Redundancy offers multiple solutions to a given problem, which could be a key of success during the evolutionary process. So there are different concepts. The concept of redundancy in mm-hmm. biology is usually associated with genetic redundancy,
sure.
because it's been discussed since the beginning of genetics, since like many, many years ago mm-hmm. when the whole discipline started. So now we include this definition of genetic redundancy in a more specific understanding okay. of functional redundancy. So we usually use this this term as functional redundancy. It's a situation where two or more genes, so we're talking about genes here, perform the same biochemical function within an individual. You want to know maybe what is a gene?
I was getting ready to ask.
I can see your face.
Because every time we interview people that are working in this, I always keep asking, like, remind me what a gene is. So yeah, so please remind me again what a gene is.
Yeah, okay. So we usually define a gene as a continuous DNA or RNA region that encodes the synthesis of a gene product. It can be RNA or a protein that can act as a functional unit of heredity. So it can be inherited. So genes are inherited from parents to the offspring and contain the information needed for specific traits. You know, I don't know, blue eyes, for example.
Okay.
Your genome, we know we talk about gene, but you always hear about genome. What is a genome? Genome is the complete set of genes. So it's your library of genes, basically.
Okay, right.
Okay. We also contain other genetic material, which is presented in a cell or in an organism. We are human, I think.
I'm hoping.
Hope we are human. And therefore, we have two copies of each gene, making our whole genome duplicated. And so, geneticists called us diploid organisms.
So, diploid is like two?
Yes.
Okay.
Because we have two copies of each gene that we have two copies. There are other organisms that have multiple copies of their genes. And they are called polyploid because they have...
Because they're many.
Yeah, it's okay. many. So they have multiple copies. For example, the humble potato.
Wait, so you're telling me a potato has more copies
yes,
of its genetic material than mine?
Depending which potato species you're looking at,
uh-huh.
can have from 2 to 6 copies of the same gene.
Okay.
Yeah. Virus and bacteria have very small genomes. They don't usually have the gene duplication. If they have, they're really, really minimal.
Mm.
And usually this is really bad for them because if they get a mutation in one of the gene, because it's not duplicated, this will have a severe impact and maybe destroy several functions simultaneously. Like, you know.
Okay, so I'll make sure I'm following along. So... there's this nice advantage for me to have 2 copies of my genetic material.
Yes.
Because if there's like a screw up somewhere, it's fine because I got another backup copy.
The other copy.
But with a virus, it doesn't have a backup, so it gets screwed up
bacteria usually, yeah, they don't have like this luxurious mm-hmm. way.
Whereas the potato, like...
The potato.
He's doing good.
Oh, man. Oh, genetically manipulate potato, it's a nightmare. You don't want to go to
okay.
doing that. Much easier with human than potatoes.
Okay.
So you can understand that from an evolutionary perspective, as you exactly saying, having multiple copies of the same gene is a powerful move to combat destructive mutation and promote biological success.
Mm, okay.
So if one gene is effective, the organism will have another functioning copies that will buffer the effect of the mutation. So consequently, the possibility to tolerate mutation can also be viewed as a mechanism to accumulate beneficial mutation. So because, you know, you will have still the mutation in your gene, but you won't have a genetic defect because you have, well, some cases you could still have it, but let's keep things very simple
sure,
for the moment.
Yeah.
You probably have like less than a major impact if you have two redundant copies.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and you will have this mutation. So if this mutation is maybe can give you an advantage, maybe not now,
mm-hmm.
but if you have another mutation in the course of your life that can, you know, maybe is in the same biological pathway,
yeah,
no, the same biochemistry pathway, so you can, you know, accumulate mutation without being sick, but maybe those mutations at some point collectively could lead to something really beneficial for maybe your offspring
okay.
later on. You could have potential evolutionary advantage for this.
Mm-hmm. So my kid are going to be the next X-Men.
Hopefully okay. not. But
okay, fine.
I don't know how I feel by that.
Sure.
as long as it's not a potato.
As long as it's not a potato. There we go.
Yeah.
Okay, now I remember at one point you were telling me about like how long like redundancy has been around, like in terms of like not just human history, but like the entire evolutionary history. Like, can you give me like some examples of like how long like this redundancy has been in place in evolution?
Okay, so I mean, gene duplication goes back to the era of the dinosaurs, and duplication that happened at that time. So like something like, I don't know, 80 million years ago or something like that.
80 million, okay.
I would say 100 million years ago.
Give or take a million years.
Yeah, we get like redundancy gene duplication that happen, and they're still present in humans.
So, okay, so the kind of... Okay, I want to make sure I'm getting this. So the kind of gene duplication you're talking about has been around for at least 100 million years, and we still find it today in
humans. Yeah, so like, for example, if... So why... You always ask me, why are you bothering working with yeast?
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
yeah.
Yeast are very different from humans.
Right.
What is the benefit of even looking at such creature?
Yeah.
Well, yeast are really, really conserved compared to human. They have like the way they're operating is really, really similar on molecular level than humans.
Okay.
Although we are very distant from yeast, we can still learn so much because the mechanism of how DNA replicate is very similar.
It's very
so
similar.
It's conserved
okay.
from yeast to humans.
Okay, so these same kind of mechanisms, these kind of redundancies in the genes, like that's been conserved over a vast portion of time.
Well, yes, some genes that duplicated many, many years ago,
mm-hmm.
million years ago, they are still around now in organisms that we can find.
Wow.
Can find.
Okay.
Yeah. So redundancy is great because it gives you... From one hand, you're safe for having bad effect of mutation,
mm-hmm.
but also give you what we call mutational robustness.
Okay.
Which is basically this potential that you get having different mutations, which are not lethal for you, but they could be beneficial at some point.
Okay, so mutationally robust if I can just handle some different mutations.
Yes.
Okay.
So you can handle them. So you don't get, you know, sometimes you cannot handle them.
Sure.
Because not all the mutations are good for you.
Right.
But, you know, most of the time, because the way the genome and the DNA is organized, most of mutation happen in places where there is not direct potential damage that could be made in that mm-hmm. part of the genome. So it just can happen a mutation there and you can just live your life normally.
Okay.
Very happily.
Okay, so that's a big advantage.
It's big advantage.
Okay. So I've got this genetic redundancy and I've got this mutational robustness.
Yes.
And these are all different kinds of advantages that I have.
Yes.
Okay, so I've got all this stuff going on in my genes. Is it happening anywhere else?
Well, you can have redundancy not just in your genes, but also you can have it also in your cells, like overall.
Mm-hmm.
If you have like a cell biology perspective, you can say that redundancy there is crucial in accomplishing the vast biochemical function that the cell has to perform. So think about that a biological pathway. Well, first of all, what is a biological pathway?
Mm-hmm.
It's basically a series of interaction among molecules that leads to a certain change or a product in a cell, okay? So basically you have, for example, molecules just bump into each other and then activate some proteins, activate some enzyme, and the outcome of that, it's, I don't know, the fact that your gene expression goes up or goes down.
Okay.
That could be seen as a biological pathway.
Okay.
Like, very simply in term.
Sure.
So biological pathways are really, can be really complicated. Some can be very easy, very mm-hmm. straightforward. Others are really complicated. Like, for example, the process of photosynthesis.
Ooh, okay.
Yeah, that rings some horror story when you were in high school,
yes,
probably.
Yes, exactly. Because I remember failing that test. It was not good.
Yeah. These are very complicated pathways that require sophisticated and optimized component in order to function, that have to function properly.
Okay.
But although they need sophisticated component, their flexibility is still guaranteed through many levels of redundancy. So you can have, for example, think about, there are some pathways that go from A to B, but they require, you know, different factor before going from A to B.
Right. Okay.
It might require C, D, and E.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But you could have, for example, an extra, if it happened that if you want to go from A to B, but you need C and D, if C fail to be doing its function, mm-hmm. it seems the old pathway won't work.
Right.
Right. Because it's necessary that it's been there.
Yeah.
What if you have something that is basically C duplicated?
Okay. So if one of them fails, the other one...
Exactly.
...is going to work. Well, hopefully.
Hopefully it's going to work. Yeah, it should work.
Yeah.
And that's what happened a lot in the human genome. We have so many genes that either we have the copy of the same gene or variants of the same genes or genes that are very, very similar. It's not the same gene, but it's slightly different.
Yeah.
But it can perform the exact same thing. So your biological pathway as a whole is still covered because you will have one of the gene that it will get there and that it will do that function.
Right.
So that's when I'm talking about cellular redundancy, that's what I mean. Like different component that can act interchangeable. Or you could have, even if it's a very, very complicated pathway, you need like bits of it to work simultaneously.
Mm-hmm.
You could have, in case of failing, a whole branch of the pathway just don't work. You could have a similar group of enzyme that performs similar action all in chain that can come through and not maybe optimally as it should, but mm-hmm. it kind of does the job.
But it still gets the job done.
Yes. And so you will have your outcome working.
Okay.
So there are like many ways in through the molecular level that you can have redundancy mechanisms that can be very useful to go for achieving the same goal, mm-hmm. ultimate goal, in different, slightly different way, but you will get there.
You'll get there in the end. Okay, so you've talked about a couple different themes here, one of which is, you've got this kind of flexibility within the system, and you've got this sort of like robustness within the system, so it mm-hmm. can handle these different changes. And so you mentioned earlier, you use the phrase risk control management.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. And so I want to kind of get back into that theme of risk control here. So can you give me a few examples of risk control management in the biological world?
Oh, okay. The first thing that comes to mind for me, it's just looking at plants. Then maybe because, you know, I was born a plant biologist mm-hmm. at some point. So you think about that as living organisms have developed numerous systems of checks and balance to thrive at their best. And if you look at plants and the control of flowering, oh my God, this is the most fascinating for me mm-hmm. biological thing ever. Because flowering of plants is not regulated just by the temperature, because we have plants that flower, for example, in spring.
Yeah.
Right? And then they make the fruit for the summer. And there we go. The seeds, and they're ready back again.
Yeah.
So it's absolutely crucial for plants to get flowering right.
Mm-hmm.
If not, they won't produce seeds, and they won't do any offspring.
Okay. So if a plant doesn't flower, then it's not going to be able to create another generation of plants.
Yes. Well, we are restricting this to flowering plants.
Sure. Right. Of course.
Then there are plants that do not produce flower.
Right.
But, you know, there are... different story there.
Sure. Okay. So we're focusing just on plants that flower.
Yes, of course. So for them, you would think like, oh, spring is getting warmer. So definitely the temperature must be one of the sensors to tell the plants we're going through summer. Mm-hmm. So it's time to get preparing for flowering. Yeah, the problem is that if you only have that, if you have an incredibly, incredibly warm winter like we had here,
right,
plants will kind of get tricked into that.
Okay,
and
sure.
And just randomly flowering, and then it gets cold again, and just not going to happen. So, you know, they have clever way to get past that. In fact, plants sense the passing of the season with a very intricate network of molecular sensors. So they are usually able to measure repetitive amounts of cold received during the cold month, but they also sense the amount of light, because obviously, if we change the season, the amount of light you get, days are get shorter in the winter or longer in the summer.
Right.
And that's kind of pretty regular.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not going to happen that in one winter you will have a longer day.
Right.
Out of nothing.
Yeah.
It would be very worrying.
Yeah.
The plants not flowering, it would be your list of your problems
right
here.
Yeah, yeah.
So they're able to sense the amount of light during the day. And because they have a clock, as we always talk about circadian clock, you mm-hmm. know, what you make you distinguish was this day or night.
Yes.
Yes, plants have exactly the same. So they have their circadian clock and they're able to estimate the amount of light. So they understand, oh, it's definitely winter now. And then, of course, they have to use the temperature control as well. So they have at least two systems there mm-hmm. that are, you know, linked to each other. So I would say that this is a beautiful control system that can account for an exceptional warm season and will prevent them to flowering at the wrong time. And it's a kind of contingency plans, I think.
Okay.
You know, because, you know, if the temperature sensor doesn't work, you have the day sensor, length of the day sensor. So this is a contingency plans. And this type of thing, if you start to investigate what happened at molecular level, you will find so many contingency plans and risk management. And if you, I'm interested in, as you are, in the most fundamental molecules, that's for our molecular biologists, are obviously DNA and RNA. Mm-hmm. So if we look at those, we can see how cells have mastered a remarkable network of surveillance and error repairing mechanisms that are able to correct function. And even in case of failing, they can still produce DNA and RNA, which, you know, they're the block of life.
Right. Okay. So I want to make sure I'm getting this. So you gave me this example of the plants of they can handle different kinds of risks because they've got these different systems to figure out what time of year it is.
Yes.
And so now you're saying, well, if I look at DNA and RNA, if I look at my own cells, we've got a whole other network of ways to manage risk. By redundancies, by these systems that can repair errors and correct for these sort of things in order to keep producing the building blocks of life.
Exactly.
Okay.
That is correct.
Okay. So before getting into these mechanisms, it might be helpful to kind of describe DNA and RNA. So if listeners check back to the episode with Ross, he went through that in more detail, but still just to get a quick reminder of what is DNA and what is RNA.
Yeah. My colleague Ross Cordiner did an amazing episode on explaining all the detail what RNA is. Mm-hmm. So I think for this episode, I'll just remind you a little bit, but not more than this, because you can definitely check his stuff.
Yeah.
So DNA and RNA are nucleic acid molecules. What they form chains, because they like to, you know, associate with each other. They have a basic structure of four kinds of nucleotide. We call nucleotide bases. And they also have a phosphate group and they have attached sugar molecule. So the bases, the phosphate and the sugar molecule, all three together compose what we call nucleotide. Okay. There are four possible nucleotides and they pair in a specific manner. And you probably hear this many times, or at least see these letters. They always refer to DNA. A, T, G, C.
Right. I always forget what they stand for, but I remember them. Yeah.
So adenine will pair with thymine, which is uridine for RNA, which is slightly different. And guanosine will pair with cytosine. So DNA, or which stands for deoxyribonucleic acid. Fancy word for you.
Very fancy.
See, sometimes I can throw fancy words around.
Yeah.
So DNA is composed of a double helix structure. Okay, so this famous ladder that everybody remember.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So it's a double helix, and it's the hereditary material in humans of almost all the organs. Not all of them, but most of them. And RNA, which is this, you know, his brothers with no people. It's like the brothers nobody remembers. No. It's like the old cousin. So important, unbelievable. Coronavirus is an RNA virus.
So. Okay, that might help people remember RNA.
Yes. That's what he has his genetic material made of. Not DNA as we do, but RNA. So RNA, or ribonucleic acid, is a single strand molecule. So it's different from DNA. DNA is a double helix. RNA has just one strand.
Okay, just one.
Yes. So it's a floating one strand. Okay. It doesn't float. We went through this a lot of time.
Mm-hmm.
But RNA has several roles in the cells. One important role is act as a messenger carrying the instruction from the DNA for controlling the synthesis of proteins. Okay?
Okay, so let's say this again, because this is important. So the RNA, you said, it's got several different roles.
Yes.
And it acts as a messenger.
Yes.
That carries instructions from the DNA.
Yes.
In order to create some proteins.
Yes.
Okay.
One of his functions is this. Then we will go through other functions, which are really amazing, that people, they're not really accustomed with.
Mm-hmm.
So proteins are larger molecules. They are composed of smaller units we call amino acids. And the amino acids are linked to each other to form long chains. We have 20 different types of amino acids that can be combined in several ways to make many, many different proteins.
Okay.
But this is all you need to know for this episode.
Sure.
We are not going to give you more detail. What we want to give you, though, it's understanding more of this redundancy mechanism that we saw before, but also risk management, mm-hmm. error repairing mechanism in particular. Well, let's look at DNA. Can DNA be, you know, when it's synthesized, when it's made, is it made it properly? Does it have mistakes? What do you think?
Because it feels like mistakes would be really bad. So I would like my DNA to avoid doing that.
You would like to have a good synthesis of your DNA if, you know, it contains all the instruction for, you know, your cellular function.
Right. Yeah. I feel like if there was an error in the instructions, that would be...
One error would be enough, or how do you feel?
I mean, in my mind, I guess I would think, like, one would be, like, enough to, like, screw the whole thing over, but then you've set it up to make me feel like maybe it's not.
Let's put this into prospect.
Yeah.
Into context. So the human genome has 6 billion base pair in each cell. Okay?
That's a lot.
So each cell has 6 billion bases.
Mm-hmm.
So the enzyme has to copy all that, because when the cell divides, she has to copy 6 billion things.
Right.
Okay? So there is an enzyme that does that. It's called DNA polymerase. This enzyme has an estimate error. So it does error.
It's okay. Okay, so it does make mistakes.
It does make mistakes.
Uh-huh.
So it does error every 104, 105 nucleotides. It makes an error. Make an estimate of 120,000 mistakes every time the cell divides.
Okay. Now, my cells are constantly dividing, and so that's 120,000 potential mistakes.
Oh, it does 120,000 mistakes in your cell. At least you have that. At least 120,000.
And my cells are, like, constantly dividing right now, so this is a lot of mistakes.
Yeah.
Right.
We are made of errors.
We're made of errors. Okay. This makes me slightly uncomfortable, but keep going.
You're not as perfect as we think.
No. My mom tells me I'm perfect, but, you know.
Aww.
But now she's wrong, so.
Yep.
Okay, so biology can be used in a premise to demonstrate that my mom is wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. Okay, there we go.
Here you go.
Mm-hmm.
So... You would think that 120,000 mistakes are a lot, but actually it's doing pretty well. It's a really good enzyme. It's very accurate. There are other ends that are much worse than this, and I will tell you in a minute the worst case.
Okay.
Because so what is really great of this enzyme is that it realizes when it does mistakes and it corrects them.
Okay.
See where you're going with this?
That's very good.
Yes. So most of the mistakes that the polymerase does are immediately rectified during the replication by this proofreading mechanism. So what happened when you have the polymerase start transcribing your DNA? If an error happened, basically what can happen? You put a different nucleotide, you put a T instead of an A. Okay. The way the nucleotide pair is really crucial, because if they are pairing correctly, the molecule will be bent in a weird way. So it's kind of pretty easy to spot the error there.
Oh, okay.
Yes. So it recognizes the error and it will take off the bad nucleotide and insert the good one. But even if it does not realize this, let's say it keeps going because it has to transcribe 6 billion bases, so kind of in a hurry.
Yeah.
What happens is this deformity in the final rigid double helix structure will be really sticking out. So this will bring other enzymes there that recognize the bulge created on the helix that will excise and substitute the incorrect nucleotides with the appropriate one.
Okay, so hang on. So this proofreading mechanism, it's going along to see, did everything get transcribed right?
Yeah, so yeah, polymerase that realize the enzyme knows, well, knows is...
Knows in a very stretched,
very
analogical
stretched
sense.
Way, yeah. Because it doesn't have eyes to see anything.
Right.
But, you know, something is wrong, it's detected something is wrong, and so the enzyme itself would correct the mechanism.
And then if that misses the error, you're saying now there's this other mechanism that's going to come along,
yes.
And it's also looking for errors to, like, get rid of them and
exactly.
correct them.
Exactly.
Okay.
Absolutely. So this is like looking at DNA, you can see that there are surveillance systems there, proofreading mechanisms for mistakes.
All right. So that's all going on just in my DNA. I've got these yes. different kinds of systems that are managing all the, well, I guess all the risk for potential errors. Like they've got a way to combat that. Mm-hmm. And that's just in DNA. Like something you've been working on a lot is that this is also going on in RNA as well.
Yes.
And so we're not going to have time to get into some of those details, but there's a whole bunch of these other mechanisms going on in DNA.
Yeah, like the only thing I want to add for that is that you have to, even though we're saying that DNA polymerase does mistakes,
yeah.
but RNA polymerase, which is the enzyme that transcribes the RNA making a copy from the DNA, has an order of magnitude 4 times higher in errors.
Okay.
Yes.
So the potential for error is even higher.
A single human cell can make 10 to 100 transcription errors per second. Per second.
Okay.
And transcription happen all the time, even more than... Because DNA replication happen all the time the cell divides.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, transcription happen all the time that gene has to be expressed within a cell.
Yes.
It's not dividing.
Right.
So your cell for functioning constantly transcribe gene all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And this enzyme, it does a lot of more errors.
Okay. So I've got even more errors, but in a similar way to the DNA, there's all these different mechanisms to repair those errors and to
yes.
spot them.
Yes. Actually, these mechanisms are even more interesting because the way, even if there are many type of RNA, we're not going to this.
Mm-hmm.
Let's just stick with the messenger RNA, which is the one that, you know, it's a copy of the DNA and then it gets processed in a way before being mature.
Okay.
Right? All along the way of his maturation process, an error can occur there, right?
Okay, yeah.
Because more step you have, more error you can have.
Right.
It's just like the nature of doing something. You have to, 2 steps, it's going to go well straight away. 15 steps, okay.
Something might go wrong.
Something might go wrong.
Yeah.
And what scientists are looking at now, this error repairing mechanism, they are starting to thinking that is it really a repairing mechanism, or is actually the cell assume that everything that is produced is actually wrong?
Mm.
So everything that is making properly has to be protected from the error repairing mechanism.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yes.
So, okay. So one of the mechanisms in my body is saying everything's definitely gone wrong.
Yes.
So let's fix everything.
Yes.
And that's...
Well, the fixing here is degrading, so destroying.
Okay, so just destroying...
Destroy everything.
Okay, so destroy all my RNA. But then I've got this other mechanism that's like, hold your horses, some of this is probably...
It's probably good somewhere.
Yeah. Okay, so I've got all these different systems going on in my body right now to fix all these different errors.
Yeah.
Okay.
I know, I think the cell is an amazing master of contingency plan. They just come up with anything, especially some unicellular organs like yeast. They will, oh my God, yeast, they will overcome anything for living.
Wow, okay.
So, yeah, they are, hopefully they're not going to be a yeast-human war at some point.
I hope not, because if they have more...
Yeast are pathogenic, so there is actually a war going on, but...
Okay.
Yeah, let's not go into that.
Okay, that's enough scary things for today. Okay.
Yeah, that's enough scary thing. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, we presented this redundancy and risk management system, which looks like very fundamental for the cells and even for having a correct biological system for, you know, be successful.
Yeah.
We rely on those strategies. But do you think... Can we maybe extend this idea to be, you know, fundamental feature of the universe that one should expect from a model of God that involves creature with free will?
I think you're onto something here. So it seems to me that if we look at this, well, I'll use an old theological phrase that I'm sure you'll love. So there's the book of scripture. And then sometimes theologians talk, there's also the book of nature.
The book of scripture is the Bible.
This is the Bible. Oh, and then the book of nature would just be...
It's got a different name.
The universe. Right.
Right.
Yeah. And so I guess what you would... What certain models of God might look at is they'll look at this and go, okay, it seems like you've got the potential, a vast potential, for lots of mistakes to be made. And God has created a system that can handle that, that anticipates that, and that is going to try to fix as many of those mistakes as possible.
Right.
And that would, I think, would benefit a bunch of different models of God, in particular, like open theism, I think, is the main model of God that would benefit.
Interesting. So, Ryan, what is open theism?
Okay, so open theism is a model of God that... affirms several things, such as creation out of nothing. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to like the divine nature itself, they're going to say God is passible, so God can be affected by the world. He's got a wide range of emotions that are consistent with his perfect rationality and his perfect goodness, so they're going to affirm those things. They're also going to say that God is mutable, which means he can change in certain respects.
Mm.
He can't change with regards to his essential nature, so he can't stop being perfectly loving.
Right.
He can't stop being all-powerful. But how he exercises his power... and how he displays his love, he can change in those ways. They're also going to say he's temporal because he changes, so he's going to undergo succession.
Mm-hmm.
And then the really interesting claim about open theism is with regards to the scope of God's knowledge. So they're going to say God knows everything.
Yes.
But certain things that other people want to say are knowable, they're going to say, no, there's nothing there to know. So when it comes to the future, they're going to say a lot of stuff about the way the future will in fact unfold. There's nothing there to know. God can know how the future might unfold,
right?
But how it will in fact unfold, they're going to say there's nothing there to know. And so that's really the key feature of open theism. And so when it comes to creating a universe, they're going to say things like, well, there's risk involved. And so, for instance, one of the titles of like a really foundational text within open theism is called The God Who Risks. So
okay.
God's taking risks when he creates. That's why when you're asking about this risk management stuff, I'm like, which model of God would that benefit the most? Well, what about the God who risks?
Oh, interesting. Mm-hmm. So what kind of universe did God create according to our open theist? And what is this God? What was God's plan?
Right. So they'll make several different kinds of claims. So one of them, they'll insist that when God's looking at the different universes he could create a universe where he determines everything to take place.
Mm-hmm.
But, well, then you're not going to get creatures with any kind of significant freedom.
Yeah.
And you're not going to be able to have, like, genuine loving relationships.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems like that's really good stuff. So God's going to want to create a universe where there is genuine freedom, where there is this possibility for loving relationships, where there can be genuine creativity. And these are different kind of values that they'll say God wants.
Mm-hmm.
And so when God's looking at the possible universes to create, he's going to create a universe that has that stuff in it, where you can have the possibility for real freedom, real creativity, real relationships. And what is God's plan with all of that? Well, God has many different plans, but one of them is to enter into friendship with as many creatures as possible.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Right. But, you know, if you have, I think I understand this risk part, where it's coming from, because if you have creature from free will, they can decide to be friends or not. Mm-hmm. And if they have open tears that God does not, it does not know the future, right? But only possibility.
Yeah.
And he has this creature with free will. Does this entail a probability of God not being able to fulfill his plan?
That's what some people say.
Okay.
And so there's a debate amongst open theists right now. So my friends Lee and Johannes, they have a paper where they talk about, they'll make this distinction between high-risk open theism, mm-hmm, and limited-risk open theism.
Right.
And so high-risk open theism is supposed to be the claim that when it comes to God's plan, which is to enter into relationships with as many creatures as possible, enter into friendship with them, mm-hmm, it's high risk in the sense that every creature could say no. Every single creature could say, God, I don't want to be friends with you.
That is weird.
Yeah. And so they say it's a possibility.
Mm-hmm. That everybody say no.
That everyone says no to God.
Okay.
The people who defend high-risk open theism, according to Lee Vysons and Joe Grossel, they'll say, you know, it's improbable. It's the probability of that happening is really low.
Okay.
But it's still definitely still there. So that's why it's high risk.
Okay.
Whereas limited risk open theism, like Greg Boyd affirms, Greg Boyd says God can guarantee the success of this plan before he even creates the universe. Mm-hmm. So will everyone say no? Of course not. That's not even a possibility. That's off the table.
Okay.
Will things not go very well along the way? Well, yeah, there's definitely risk of that. Oh, yeah. Could some really horrible things happen while we're getting there? Oh, yeah, you bet. So the risks are elsewhere.
Right.
But the risk of everyone saying no to God, that's gone. Okay. How many people will say yes to God's, his offer of friendship? Greg Boyd's like, I don't know that. But God can guarantee ahead of time that, at least one person's going to say yes. It makes a stronger claim that like some group of people will say yes.
So for God's plan to be fulfilled, just one person has to say, "I'm a friend with you."
This is what tickles me about this is the way this debate is unfolded. I'm like, that seems like that's the claim. Is this just the
bar is very low?
That seems like a really low bar. And then in which case I want to go, if that's how low the bar is. Mm-hmm. What is this high risk view even talking about? Surely God could figure out ahead of time. Like I know I can at least get one person to say yes. And I think that's just I think it's a product of how the debate has gone and has developed. I don't think people have noticed that that's what's really going on here.
Right.
But either way, there is all this talk of there being a lot of risk involved in God creating a universe. And
I'm feeling like, so definitely there are going to be a risk management system there that we see them in, we look at the biological war, mm-hmm, we find them in there. So do you think there is such a thing for other creature, maybe?
So you're saying when you look at the book of nature, right? The book of nature.
I did say that somewhere.
So the book of nature has
back
all this.
In the 17th century, everyone.
Because that's when these.
Exactly.
That's when the terms were developed. Right. So when you look at the biological world, you're like, well, look, there's all this risk management stuff.
And it seems like everywhere.
It's everywhere.
It's like every fundamental thing has.
Mm-hmm.
So
why wouldn't God do that elsewhere? Yeah, and so I think the open theists need to kind of roll back some of their claims about how risky God is and go, well, if he's going to do risk management elsewhere, why wouldn't he do it in terms of his offer of friendship? And so I think there's different kinds of risk management things that God could put into the universe. Mm-hmm. One of which is, well, he needs to create creatures that have the right kind of cognitive mechanisms.
Right.
In order to enter into friendship.
Yes.
Because if they don't have the right kind of cognitive faculties, well, then you're not going to get any friends.
Yeah.
So you need creatures who are capable of recognizing other minds. And cognitive scientists are always pointing out that, humans develop theory of mind really early age. And then you also need creatures.
Also animals, I think.
And animals, it seems like, I didn't want to get into animals because I don't know what's all over there. But
it seems like, it's not just humans.
Right. So. Because like elephants, for example, seem like they have some kind of mourning process and might even go back to like grave sites.
Like whales as well.
Whales, seem like they can recognize when they've lost like they're like a child of some sort. Yeah. We see this in different kinds of monkeys and apes. So, there's a lot of different things going on. And then apparently squids will punch fish in the face just... just because it's fun, or just because they're angry. So it seems like different creatures have the ability to recognize other minds. Mm-hmm. And that's really important, that God gives people, or the creatures, this cognitive equipment to do that. If you want to punch a fish in the face, God's created an open world where fish punching, that's totally possible. It's a possibility. Other things it seems like God would need to create would be creatures that not simply can recognize other minds, but can also recognize God himself. Mm. And so, again, to go back to the olden days, back to the 1600s, so this guy during the Reformation, named John Calvin, came up with this phrase called the sensus divinitatis, which is just this innate awareness of the divine that he said humans have. And that actually does fit with a lot of contemporary cognitive science, which indicates that human persons naturally develop beliefs about transcendent realities, divine beings, by like the age of 5. Mm. So not only do kids develop theory of mind about other people, about other humans, they also develop theory of mind about a divine being. And you're like, well, that seems like one way to kind of prime creatures for a relationship with God. Yeah, so that's one thing, but it only mitigates so much risk. Mm-hmm. You need other stuff. And I think other things that God would put in place would be things like, you know, making sure that creatures have like the right sort of moral faculties to figure things out, the right sort of rational faculties to discern maybe what God wants. But then also to make himself known, so he could maybe reveal himself through a prophet. Mm-hmm. And all the major religions that I'm aware of, so Hinduism, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, they're going to say what God does at various points in history when things are not going very well, maybe a very kind of dark sort of time, or maybe when things are going right, but God's like, hang on, I'm going to send a prophet to tell you what needs to be done now. Because a prophet just means God's mouthpiece.
Okay.
And so a successful prophet, what a successful prophet does is tells people like, this is what God wants from you right now. This is what's going on right now. Please stop acting that way. Please do this instead.
Okay.
You know, please don't sacrifice those children.
Usually nobody listen to them. So.
There's a couple cases in the Bible where that happens, where
seems
there's
like
a prophet.
Constantly happens.
Yeah, and there might even be a couple cases in the Bible where God tells the prophet ahead of time, you're going to go tell these people this thing, and none of them are going to listen to you. Are you ready for that? And the prophet's like, okay, fine. So it doesn't always go well. But a successful prophet will at least be able to establish some kind of community that based around this message, whatever the message happens to be. And there'll be a set of rituals and practices that will transmit that message on to each new generation and kind of preserve that message. And so there'll be stuff that kind of help correct people's moral practices and their religious practices towards God. And if you really want to ramp it up, which is what Christianity wants to do, they're going to be like, well, I won't give you just a prophet. I'll give you something more. I'll give you God himself coming. So I'll give you an incarnation.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so these might be things that God would put in place to kind of ensure that things would go a particular way.
Right.
And so some different kinds of risk management systems that God might put in place.
So we still have freedom then, we still have free will.
Mm-hmm. Because you're still responding to whatever God does. Because most of our free actions, what are they? They're responses to the environment.
Yeah.
You know, if I want to like give you something or do something for you, I'm responding to who you are, this person that's in front of me. Same thing with God. If God says, hey, let's be friends. And I'm like, I don't know. I'm responding to something that God has done.
So you think we are all primed to be in a friendship with God. Mm-hmm. And it's up to us to use that or not.
It's up to us what we want to do with that.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And I think God's going to be making different kinds of actions throughout history and at various points throughout our lives to try to ensure that we'll get as close to
as
possible.
This fact that we also have this type of, you know, prime behavior, if you want to put it that way, I find it really fascinating because I find it's been exploited so much by, you know, Facebook, for example. It wants to make you buy stuff.
Yes.
So I really think that's a really good possibility. Because if we can predict, basically, based on pattern of human behaviors and manipulate those patterns, well, in the worst case scenario. It seems like we are a very predictable creature. So, you know, for an all-knowing being, it'd be pretty easy to find out what our future is going to be.
It seems like he could. And so this is where I find the discussions in theology interesting, because you've got a lot of people who really don't like open theism and they're like, God's so risky. He's just going to bet away the farm, and he's going to, you know, he could really screw things up. He could really, you know, I'm like, okay, but you're also really, really terrified of, you know, these super AIs taking over mm-hmm. and predicting all your behavior.
Exactly.
And like, and you like, you mentioned
a computer can yeah. do it.
Yep. Exactly.
But God cannot do it.
Right. And so I might think maybe your view of God is really kind of small, maybe really limited. When your view of AI and Cambridge Analytica and these other things taking over, it's really, really high.
Yeah.
Maybe you should flip those around.
You might think.
Yeah. Yeah. So it seems to me that if we really are scared of these things, and I think we should be scared of the predictive power that these AIs have, mm-hmm. it might be, what's so scary about it? Well, because it might get in the wrong hands.
Yeah.
But if you're looking at an open theist God, well, it's a God who's perfect in love, perfect in power. And if he's got that kind of predictive power that an AI has, but even more, I would think it'd be much more.
Yeah.
That hopefully makes you feel a little bit safer, like you're in better hands. Because you're not in Cambridge Analytica's hands, you're in God's hands. Exactly, okay. You're in God's hands. And there you have it, another episode of the Reluctant Theologian Podcast. Stay tuned for episodes on mental health, posthumanism, and so much more.